The Triathlon Show 353. What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Bex Milnes. Bex is the lead paratriathlon coach at Bridge Triathlon's Performance Center in Loughborough, where she has a squad of really great athletes, including Paralympic and Commonwealth Games medalists. She also coaches a handful of top-class long-course triathletes, including athletes like Nikki Bartlett and India Lee. And in this interview, we discuss her approach to triathlon training and coaching, differences between training for short course and long course triathlon, group training, paratriathlon training, and much, much more. But first, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that create sports nutrition products, including both carbohydrate and electrolytes. And they help you use these products effectively through a range of free tools, services, and content. Precision Fuel and Hydration have partnered up with Swift Tri Academy and will be helping the Swift Tri Academy athletes nail their nutrition and hydration strategy for Kona. In parallel with that, they will be running monthly group rides on Swift, with the next one being on the 8th of September. If you just Google Precision Fuel and Hydration Swift Ride, you will find the link with all of the information for these monthly group rides. Also remember that as a listener of the podcast, you can get 15% off PFNH products by using the code TTS22 at checkout on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And remember that they offer free video consultations and a free fuel and hydration planner on their website. And thank you to Roka. Roka produces exceptional quality triathlon wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, performance sunglasses, and prescription eyeglasses and sunglasses. In the range of Roka's eyeglasses and sunglasses, they have a number of great features, including the Geico anti-slip technology, meaning that the glasses will never fall off your face. They are all extremely lightweight and they have unbelievable optics. The performance sunglasses are used at the very highest level in sports, from triathlon through base jumping and speed skating. And for prescription glasses, there is a home tryout program so that you can try out different options for frames. And you can renew your prescription with a simple online vision test at home in front of your computer. All products have multiple options for frame and lens, and they all come with a 2-year warranty. And my personal favorites are the Rory prescription glasses, the Phantom Aviator sunglasses, and the Matador Air Performance sunglasses for sports. Visit roka.com/TTS to get 20% off your entire Roka order. Now, without any further ado, here's the interview with Coach Bex Milnes. Welcome to the Triathlon Show, Bex. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Yeah, not too bad. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for having me on. It's been a pretty busy summer so far. So I was just before we jumped on, just saying I'm at home in Loughborough at the moment, just re-energizing before the second half of the season. So yeah, it's a nice opportunity to chat.
Yeah, it's a good window of opportunity between a lot of a hectic racing schedule or going to races for coaching. So why don't you start by telling us a little bit more about who you are and your current roles within coaching and within the sport of triathlon?
Yeah, so as it stands at the moment, I'm the lead para triathlon coach for Great Britain, so the national federation. I'm based in Loughborough and predominantly work with world class program athletes on the para tri team. So those athletes are kind of full time. Their main focus is around sprint distance, non-drafting racing. And they're heavily focused on Paris. And so all the prep and focus is around that. And predominantly, focus on achieving Paralympic medals. So that's my main full-time job at the moment. Alongside that, I also coach a small group of athletes that kind of range from pro long distance through to age group. So I dabble a little bit in the longer distance side of things, and find that to be a really useful kind of coaching tool and part of my coach development. Longer term, actually at the end of this year, that'll change slightly. So I've decided to step away from my role as para triathlon coach, and will be full time kind of in a private coaching setup at the end of the year. So yeah, just in the midst of a bit of a change at the moment, but really enjoying the diversity of the coaching that I'm doing.
Yeah. So just to set the context for listeners that know about paratriathlon and long distance triathlon, who are some of the top paratriathletes and long distance triathletes that you're coaching?
Yeah, so I currently coach George Peasgood, who was a silver medalist in Tokyo in the PCS5 men's, recently just retained his title as world TT champion from a paracycling perspective as well. So I coach him, Claire Cashmore, Dave Ellis, and Luke Pollard, his guide. And then on the long distance side of things, I coach Nikki Bartlett, who is also my fiance. Alongside India Lee, Jodie Stimpson, Rosie Weston, who's an up-and-coming pro. So yeah, quite a diverse mix, really.
Yeah, all right. And did you spend a lot of time as an athlete yourself coming up through the British ranks, or what's your background? What led you into coaching?
Yeah, a little bit. I competed in the sport mainly as kind of a junior, a little bit under 23. So I actually trained alongside Jodie Stimpson when I first started in the sport, and had aspirations of going on to be an Olympian, and trained predominantly for the draft legal side of triathlon, and pretty quickly figured out that my ambition wasn't matched by my physical ability. So I always, alongside training, had coached, whether that be volunteering at a tri club or helping university students out, and just found it a natural kind of progression from being an athlete. I loved coaching, I loved helping people, I loved figuring out the sport of triathlon, and yeah, just kind of naturally fell into coaching from being an athlete, really.
Yeah, all right, that's great. A great story. And let's transition into some of your thoughts on coaching and training. So first, this question is always the hardest, I find, but if you can give it a shot, how would you describe your coaching philosophy or your approach to triathlon training?
Yeah, I think for me, it probably hinges on like three key determinants. So I always start off with like, what are the demands of the sport? And obviously, as you kind of heard in the intro, I coach across a range of, you know, everything from sprint distance right through to Ironman. So the demands of the sport have nuances within them, although they're all, you know, swim, bike, run. But it's always based on like understanding that first, and then understanding the individual that I'm coaching and where they sit alongside those demands of the sport. So essentially figuring out where the gaps are, where we're best placed to make biggest gains. And then once we understand that, the third component for me is the person, like understanding the athlete that I'm coaching on a personal level. So that's kind of, like their motivations, what it is they're trying to do, what they want from a coach, where their core values sit as a person and how aligned that is to me. And once I kind of understand that picture, for me, then it's all about like planning and how you look to tackle what it is they're trying to achieve, and how you look to do it over a period of time. I think, I've certainly fallen into the trap in my early coaching days of trying to do everything at once. And it just ends up in a bit of a mess, to be honest. So yeah, I think the understanding the demand of the sport, understanding where the athlete I'm working with sits within that, understanding them as a person, and then planning, putting in place a plan to tackle what it is they're trying to do, would be how I approach, yeah, most coach-athlete relationships, really.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I want to follow up on that, what you said about not making a mess of it and understanding the time course of what you're working on. So can you give an example of, you know, something that you might have had to develop with an athlete at some point in time and how you went about it? And then, I guess, as a contrast, or what would have been a bad way to go about it as opposed to what you did now, knowing what you know now?
Yeah, I think in my early days, it's like when you're creating that gap analysis, it's really easy to go, you know, the demands of the sport sit here. This is what world's best looks like. And, you know, you'd end up with a list the length of your arm in terms of what the athlete needed to improve on. And, you know, hypothetically, you'd end up in a scenario where you're trying to improve like second threshold on the bike alongside running mechanics, alongside improving swim technique and tactical awareness in racing. And I'd find that it would just like, yeah, in my inexperience, I'd try to tackle that all at once. So, you know, through the course of a week, you'd be trying to tick off all those things. And I think pretty quickly I learned that actually in order to develop something properly, it takes time and it takes, there's a need to create space within the program to do that. And there's only probably a couple of things that you can be focusing on really at one time in order to properly develop it. And so I started to then take a much more kind of longer term view on athlete development. And I think particularly within a sport like triathlon, which is endurance based and takes years and years to develop. I started to take a much longer term view on how to tackle those things. And actually, if you're trying to push on a second threshold on the bike, then you're like how much you're running and what the composition of your run training is also heavily impacts that. And if you're trying to do it all at the same time, you just end up, yeah, just making a mess of it. So yeah, I think understanding what you're trying to work on and prioritizing it is critical. And it may mean that you take backward steps in other areas to do that. But ultimately, as long as you're kind of moving forwards as a whole, that's the important bit.
I was going to ask about, you mentioned prioritizing, and if you have that list of gaps, the length of your arm, how do you prioritize? Like, would you, I mean, I get that it's always going to depend, but do you have any general guidelines? Would you go for the lowest hanging fruit first, or would you maybe start with something that is really challenging and is going to take a long time, like the swim for an athlete that is maybe behind on the swim, and swim is always going to be very important, especially in draft legal racing? Or yeah, what are some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it comes down to a little bit what you described there. So yeah, like if you take the swim as an example in draft legal racing, it's absolutely critical. Like, it sets up your race. And it's understanding how long it takes to develop you know, your ability to swim front pack. And it could be that you know, you look at that from a coaching perspective and you've got a female that's swimming 5 minutes for 400. And in order to be front pack, they need to be 420 for 400. Well, you know that that's going to take, you know, good 3-4 years minimum to sort that out, unless they're really untapped in their potential. So, but you also know that if you don't address it and you don't prioritize it, then they're probably never going to achieve what they want to achieve. So that, although that could be a 4-year project, that's got to be high priority. But alongside that, there could be some really low hanging fruit, which is, you know, tactical decisions within racing in relation to swimming. And you're working in an area which is trying to develop their awareness in a race so they can maximize the ability to swim on hips or feet or whatever, so that it whilst the physiological side of their swimming may be trying to develop, their tactical awareness is kind of making up for that a little bit. And that could be a real quick, easy win. I think it's the balance of both, so that you're not kind of stripping away an athlete, you know, saying to an athlete, you know, you're not going to improve for 4 years. It's, there are always stuff like little wins along the way that you can be working on, but the big stuff you have to plan for, and you have to recognize that it takes time. And I think that's often the hardest thing to convey to athletes at times is just you're going to have to work at this, and you're going to have to work over it over a number of years in order to get better. And I think those improvements are the hardest to quantify and to see a lot of the time.
For sure. Yeah. But it does make sense to combine a really important long-term goal with maybe some more medium or even short-term improvements that can be made, because then, yeah, as you said, getting those wins along the way and small improvements as you're just chipping away at that big but slow progress that you're making. So getting back to the demands of the sport and the differences between the different modalities or the different distances that we have, so long distance versus draft legal versus non-draft sprint distance and all the things that we have these days, can we, if we just compare, let's say, for argument's sake, sprint distance and half a full Ironman, what would a high-level overview of some of the things that are typically different in your approach when it comes to coaching those two distances or three distances, I guess?
Yeah, I think I always start from where the commonalities sit first and foremost. And I think for me and my understanding of triathlon is that obviously you're training the three disciplines, but the overall aim, whether you're looking at super sprint or through to Ironman, is to be as efficient as possible in those three disciplines. So you're moving as quickly as you can for the least amount of effort in order to conserve energy for when you need to deploy it most in the race, or where it matters most. And so that's always, like, regardless of the distance, that's always kind of what I'm considering along the way, is how can we make this as efficient as possible. But then when it comes down to, like, the individual race distances, of course the demands of the race change. And the distance influences that, the dynamic, you know, if you're draft legal, heavily influences that as well. And I almost picture it as kind of like, I don't know, dials on a DJ deck, not that I'm a DJ, but like you're essentially dialing up the important bits for the demands of the race that you're doing, and you're dialing down where it's not so important. So if I think about at the start of my career, I work primarily with the draft legal side of the sport. And so, you know, that kind of technical, tactical awareness is absolutely critical. Yes, you need the kind of physiological underpinning to be successful, but the nuances that are happening within the race are so small, and your decision-making, you know, 2 seconds lost in transition could be the difference of making a front bike pack and not. And so the margins are really small. And I guess as you progress to kind of the longer distance, the sport at the moment doesn't demand that your skill level is as high as Olympic draft legal racing. So there's more margin for error. But I think in working in the longer distance side of things, what I've realized is just like what the physiological capacity of some of the athletes are, like particularly on the bike. And I remember, you know, I only really got into the long distance side of things as a consequence of Nikki, my fiance, starting to race it. And initially I didn't coach her, I just kind of supported and observed. But I remember kind of my preconceived ideas over what good was on a bike in draft legal racing. And then started to unpick a little bit what that looked like in long distance. And it really shifted what my thinking was around what good could be. And so obviously in the longer distance side of things, you spend the majority of your time on the bike and running. And so naturally swimming, for the most part, is a lesser priority. Although, you know, depending on your race dynamic, that changes. Particularly when you've got people like Lucy Charles and Lucy Hall and decent swimmers in the field. But yeah, the bike and the run are significant in terms of the time you spend on them. So you have to invest the time there. And so you have to put the priority there. But I think it's just, I guess, immersing myself in the wide spectrum of the sport, I've learned so much more as a consequence and thought differently. Like the sprint distance paratriathlon dynamic that I'm in, quite often down to impairment or athlete training history, you're limited by how much, just purely how much training an athlete can do. And so you have to think a little bit more outside the box and how you can acquire load without necessarily going down the traditional route of, you know, train 25 to 30 hours a week. And I think that's really just helped shape different ways, different approaches that are very transferable across all areas of the sport, really. But yeah, it definitely differs depending on race distance. But ultimately, I still come back to the point. The way I see it is you're just trying to create efficiency first and foremost, so that when you need to use
what does that look like in practice? Efficiency, like, I mean, when I hear that, my thoughts go to, for example, specificity, like they're not the same, but when you train specifically for what you're going to do in a race, then that's one way of creating, or hopefully creating, efficiency. But is that what you mean, or do you have any other ways of developing efficiency?
I think it comes back to, for me, efficiency is like physiological metabolic efficiency. So how do you make your engine, what you've got, as efficient as possible? For, like, obviously from a long distance perspective, fueling becomes more important, but it's important across the spectrum. So there's that level of efficiency. There's kind of the technical underpinning of how you move, because obviously the cost of that can be pretty significant if you're poor technically, and can be significantly less if you're good technically. And then tactically as well, like, there's a tactical element in all areas of triathlon, and it's how much you engage in that and recognize that. I think ultimately those three things for me lead to efficiency. And there are, like, the further away from the racing you are, the more kind of that physiological metabolic side of things becomes, like, is dialed up in terms of importance. The closer to racing you get, the more the kind of technical, sorry, tactical element becomes more critical. But in essence, I see, like, it's all about going as quick as you can for the least cost.
Yeah. And following up on what you said about getting into long distance coaching and seeing what was possible on the bike, for example, is that something, have you brought any training methods that you've learned through your exposure to long distance into your sprint paratriathlon coaching, or vice versa? Have you cross-pollinated training methods between those two modalities and found that helpful?
Yeah, for sure. I think, what I observed from the long distance side of things is that there was just a greater priority on the bike and creating space within the week to, you know, whether that's distribution of intensity or time spent at intensity or overall volume. It varied individual to individual, but particularly for sprint distance, non-drafting racing on the paratri side of things, there's a lot of transferables, like certainly the way in which you train, the time you would need to dedicate. Although it's only sprint distance, you're still trying to create an aerobic underpinning. You're still trying to ensure that you're pushing your VO2 max as high as possible and then have a second threshold that supports that. You're still working on some pretty key principles there. But I think what the bits which I've carried over most from a paratri perspective is actually more the aerodynamic elements that I think from a long distance triathlon, particularly when I started to get more involved, was really starting to kick off and people were paying much more attention to it. Whereas in paratri, when I first started, you still had people kind of rolling around on road bikes with clip-on bars and road helmets and you know, not using disc wheels. And I've kind of seen that over the last 3 years, that's really started to shift. And people within paratri have started to pay a lot more attention to those level of details. And I think that's certainly come from, the longer distance side of things and what's been role modeled there.
Moving on a little bit to a different topic, I assume that within the paratriathlon group in Loughborough that you have a typical group daily training environment, and I just wanted to ask you, what are the pros and cons of that kind of group environment, and how do you manage the group so that you can maximize the benefits and mitigate any potential disadvantages?
Yeah, I think it's always a balance, right? And a little bit comes down to how much the individual athlete places value on the group. But for the most part, I think if anybody's like deliberately engaging in a centre, it's because they value people being around them and they value the group, they value the day-to-day coaching that they get. And so I think it's, for me, when working with like world-class program athletes, I would generally take an approach of like, what's the individual need first, like prioritize that first. But then I very much see my role as a coach as, once you understand that and you understand the individual needs within your group, where are the opportunities to knit stuff together so that they benefit from, you know, just morale and share, you know, when you're rocking up every day and each week you're training pretty hard. There are days where, you know, people come in and they're, you know, really struggling with either motivation or just energy. And you immediately see how being in a group environment that gets lifted. And they can suddenly get more from themselves than what perhaps they would do if they just rocked up, you know, trackside or poolside or roadside and were delivering a session individually. So that's a massive pro. I think the cons, you know, are just that exact balance. Like, where do you individualize and what does that mean for, you know, for potentially needing to do things on your own? And I think that's, again, where I see my role as a coach to flex that through the year. So where individual becomes more important than group. I think there's also just like group training hinges on relationships being good. And I'm very grateful and thankful that the athlete group that I work with, they get on really well and they respect one another. We obviously have world-class program athletes, but we also have pathway athletes. And I think often in that setting, the benefit is sometimes more to the pathway athletes because they can see what world's best looks like in their daily training environment. They know the habits and the underpinning behaviors that they need to role model themselves. So I think that can be of huge benefit. And then there's just the real boring, mundane stuff, like just, you know, if someone comes in with a cold, then it's really easy to wipe out the training group. And so I think like just being clear with, you know, respecting the group, respecting the environment, and how everybody plays a part within that. But on the whole, I think that's one of the big advantages of being, you know, a national federation that supports training centres. Within the UK, we have, I think it's 5 training centres that people could train out of. And I do feel that is really instrumental in the success that we've had so far. And if I compare it again to the longer distance side of things, where, you know, if you're one of the world's best, then you have the opportunity to create a team around you. But for the most part, the majority of athletes are trying to go it alone, you know, training in all sorts of makeshift training environments. You see massively how that impacts everything. And so, yeah, I think without rambling too much, I think a group and a supportive environment is certainly something which is of massive benefit.
There's a lot of interesting things there. First of all, you mentioning that at the world-class program that the individual comes first and then you work with that, but within the group. But this is just a very, not very uninformed, but definitely an outside perspective into what's going on in different training groups around the world. But sometimes it seems like not all, but some training groups at the Olympic distance or short distance are more about the group is what it is, and you join the group and then you do the group's training. And again, I don't know the ins and outs of everything that's going on there, but do you get that impression sometimes, or do you think that all groups kind of operate in that same way that you are?
I think from what I observe, and I'm only referencing kind of I can only speak to the environment that I'm in, but I think what I observe is it almost works on a hierarchical basis. So if you're almost the better you become and the more proven you become as an athlete, the more individualization you're then rewarded with, and the more the group flexes to support your individual needs. But I do think, like, when you look at it, I do think for the most part, you can get a hell of a long way off what is a pretty generic training group if you do the basics right. I think the need for individualization certainly comes at a point. But I think if you're a young, aspiring, inexperienced athlete, just simply being in an environment which you have a role model of what world's best looks like, and you're immersing yourself in it and learning from the athlete, the more senior athletes in the group, then you can get a lot from that. And so I think from a coaching perspective, if you have 20 athletes in your group, I'd argue it's nigh on impossible to coach them all individually to the highest level that you could. I think, you know, you're probably looking at 5 athletes maximum that you can really, really coach to a very high level. But that's not to say that, like I say, that athletes can't benefit, other athletes can't benefit from that and get a lot from it. Mm.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer. And then the other follow-up question on that was, having seen the benefits of the group environment, is that something with your long-distance athletes that you are trying to help them build some sort of group training environment or support network? Is that something that you talk with your athletes about and try to create something like that?
Yeah, I think aspirationally, if there is an unlimited, not unlimited resource, but even a resource to put towards creating a long distance training environment, then I genuinely feel that that would be a huge benefit. I think it's one of the challenges of the long distance side of the sport, and particularly within the UK, and I know this differs country to country, the focus of funding, the focus of resource and people's time is very heavily weighted towards Olympic and Paralympic sport, and that's for very obvious reasons. And so, you know, just alone setting up a training group which provides facilities is very basic. You're probably looking at the best part of 30k to do that a year. And that's before you then get into, you know, what world-class program athletes have access to, which is a whole team of practitioners and race trips supported and camp support and, you know, all of that. It's huge, like, financial resource in order to do that. So I always encourage athletes to seek out environments that will support them. But I think it's exceptionally hard to do from a long distance perspective. And that's kind of, why you see people a bit more kind of transient in where they base themselves and looking and creating groups themselves. But yeah, the cost of it is significant to do it properly.
Yeah, I think that was more what I was alluding to, creating your own training groups, not so much setting up a training center, because that's going to be very cost prohibitive. Moving on again to discussing the different modalities within triathlon, if you could share some key fundamental principles of your training process within swim, bike and run, and let's start with swimming.
I think just again, if I just generally speak to across all three disciplines, like, first and foremost, it kind of seems obvious to say, but they all interact and impact on one another. And so, fundamentally, I work across trying to develop, you know, an aerobic underpinning, an efficiency at first threshold, an efficiency at second threshold, and VO2. And that's kind of the bones of swim, bike, and run. I think for they each then have different nuances in how you tackle that. And again, it can be quite individually led. But swimming, I think some of the things that I consider is, like, just volume first and foremost, distribution of intensity. So the majority of the swim programs that I set would have a large aerobic component, probably 70-80% of the swim program that I would set is aerobic in structure. We may focus on like open water skills elements of that or strength based elements. But then the kind of main energy systems that I primarily focus on would be around that kind of second threshold or critical swim speed and VO2. And that's predominantly where we spend most of the intensity. That may flex a little bit through the year, like earlier on in winter, I tend to do a bit more of an anaerobic capacity stimulus or pure speed stimulus because I find that kickstarts into the VO2 quite nicely. But fundamentally, it's the transferability to open water is the critical bit. And in order to swim open water well, it comes down to efficiency, but it comes down to kind of stroke rates, being able to manage the conditions that you're swimming in, a strong technical underpinning and a tactical awareness. So they're all elements which try to consider over the course of the year and prepare athletes for, really.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. A couple of follow-up questions on that. So when you have the 70-80% of the aerobic swimming, how do you prescribe that? How do you make sure? Because that's something that I see quite a bit, that in the swimming in particular, it tends to be difficult to get that intensity right. It's easy to go too hard. And maybe with world-class athletes, not so much, but also working with young up-and-coming athletes, I do think that it can be an issue. So how do you work with the prescription and also with athletes' understanding of intensity to get that right?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think everybody, I certainly share your reflections on it. It's really hard, particularly in the swim, it's really hard to prescribe intensity. And I've experimented over the years with heart rate monitors and various bits and pieces. But it tends to be the equipment that is the limiting factor most of the time. And actually, I found the most effective way across swim, bike and run, actually, like a common theme that I use is just RPE, like rate of perceived exertion, and really consistently using that as a measure for athletes and them being self-aware enough to know how they're feeling on a given day and what RPE is at a given intensity. And so whenever I'm prescribing a session, there tends to be like ballpark time that you should be aiming for, or power or pace, but alongside of that is always RPE. And that is the thing which in all sessions I'm sure athletes go mad at me for it, but I will refer to my first question will be, what was your RPE for that? And that tends to be a pretty staple, consistent measure, which accounts for fatigue. It's so simple, and we've got so many gadgets that you can use. But yeah, the most reliable one, it comes back to just, yeah, how hard were you working there?
It's the one that encompasses everything: external workload, internal workload, and fatigue, as you say, and environmental conditions. So, yeah. So it's definitely the most complete, the complete metric. But because it's subjective in a way, I think that's why maybe it's not as appreciated as it should be.
Yeah, and I really think it's important for athletes to be self-aware. I think there's so much about what I see, some of the pitfalls and rabbit holes that athletes get themselves into is relying on a Garmin or a Fitbit or a Whoop recovery band to tell them how they're feeling. And it's not that those gadgets don't have their place. Of course they do. And they add, a bit of an evidence base. But I think fundamentally you have to trust in how you feel and be really in tune with that. Because at the end of the day, if you're in a race scenario and everything fails and all you're left with is you, you have to be competent and confident enough to know what that feels like. And I think it's, again, you can limit, I've seen it so many times, you can limit yourself by numbers and what how you should feel be based on a test that you did one day as a moment in time. And you can be really, I've seen athletes be really rigid with training zones and recovery scores and all of that. And I think it's having an understanding and an appreciation for that information, but not been limited by it or restricted by it. And so, yeah, for me, it's probably actually one of the most critical things is athletes understanding themselves I really value.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other follow-up question on swimming is the open water transferability. So how do you do a lot of specific open water swimming during the summer when you can? And do you also work with it in the pool? Can you discuss how you make sure that the athletes can transfer their swimming into the open water?
Yeah, I mean, obviously living in the UK, it's not that conducive to open water swimming all the time. But we definitely dedicate at least a couple of sessions a week through the summer to like being in the open water. I think the differences that I notice is the open water component is far more strength based. I think when we've used, ironically, heart rate as a bit of a measure through like a pool threshold session compared to open water, heart rate tends to sit a little bit lower open water, but the strength component is more significant. So. In terms of through, like particularly through the winter when we can't swim open water, I will use a lot of paddle band work. As boring as the athletes may find it, I do a lot of like just continual swimming in the same way that we would ask an athlete to go out and do a long run or a long bike. At least, you know, once a week, they will have, you know, anything from kind of half an hour to an hour of just continual swimming. And that's all part of like building that strength, and aerobic underpinning and technical efficiency that is needed when it comes to then open water. I get a fair bit of stick now and again from athletes because they find it boring, but I do think it's really important. And I see a lot of time, particularly this is probably more age group, swimming, but I see a lot of time being dedicated towards technique and almost the emphasis on drills. And again, I'm not saying that doesn't have its place. It definitely does. But I also think, particularly when it comes to swimming, you also have to just swim and you develop proficiency just through doing it consistently and over a period of time. And if you're constantly stopping every 25, 50 meters or 100 meters, then you're recovering and it alters the stimulus that you're then getting from it.
Yeah, and also coming back to an earlier point of the intensity control, when you do swim those longer continuous sets, then it becomes easier to make sure that you don't swim too hard. And I won't go on about this too much because actually the very day that we record this, I released a new podcast episode where I did talk quite a lot about some of the thinking that I have around swim training. And I talked about exactly that, doing long continuous reps and things like that. But the other thing, the thing that I didn't mention in that episode that I can mention here to add to the conversation is that you just end up having very efficient workouts. You can get a lot of distance in a short time. And if you're focused, then you can get in, let's say, 4,000 strokes in an hour and a little bit, instead of in many sessions, you get in 4,000 strokes, you're there for an hour and a half. So I find that, it just saves a lot of time and where a lot of the time might previously have been spent on things that were not necessarily that all that beneficial.
Yeah. And I think genuinely, like when you look at how swim sessions are constructed, particularly on aerobic stuff, I think it's mainly based on entertainment for the athletes, like how to keep the athlete engaged. When the reality is like, that if you were to be like, what's the most efficient way to develop this? You'd just be like, just swim, like just swim and swim for a long period of time, and don't stop. So, yeah, I think it's also important for athletes, particularly on the long distance side, to overcome boredom and to keep focus and to be challenged in that way. Because if you're going to an Ironman and that's the first time you're swimming for anywhere, you know, 45 minutes to an hour and a half, whatever, and that's the first time you've done it continually, there's a huge mental component to that. That if you're not training, then you just come unstuck. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. That's the swim set that I did today was 6x600 easy with 20 seconds rest or so between. That's it. Very simple, very boring, but I do that every single week. I do that. All right. Well, biking. What are some thoughts around biking?
Yeah, so I think, it depends a little bit on the individual. But from a riding perspective, I similarly would... intensity distribution would sit around 80 to 20, so a fair bit of aerobic riding. But what I tend to focus on with the aerobic riding stuff, a little bit dependent on time of year, but particularly as we're in race season, I would prioritize like how people are riding aerobically. And what I mean by that is aerodynamic drills, focus on holding race position, a little bit of like, particularly on the longer distance side, training for the demands of the course that you're doing. So if you're going to race a really hilly race, then I would certainly prescribe on aerobic stuff, like just getting used to overgearing, getting used to working over the top of hills or whatever it is. And then this is probably where it varies a little bit depending on distance, but from a riding perspective, if you're racing 70.3 or Ironman, then your first threshold you have to be super efficient around that. And I would structure at least a session a week that focuses on developing that. And I think generally, if those sessions are done well and fueled well, the cost of them is relatively low for a session. But that has to be a focus. And then a little bit depending on the athlete engine and what I'm working with, whether they're, I kind of would term it as like more of a Ferrari or a diesel, would then determine kind of how I then structure either a second session in the week or a second emphasis on cycling, whether I'd sit more of kind of like a second threshold efficiency or a VO2. But yeah, I tend to, as a general rule, prescribe a couple of bike sessions in a week, and then the rest is aerobic. And as we get closer to the season, we'd structure brick sessions off the back of either one of those aerobic rides or one of those key sessions. But I think, yeah, I'm big on riding in the position that you're racing in, preparing for the specifics of the course that you're riding, and making sure you're as efficient as possible, and that is time on bike.
yeah absolutely. I was going to say, regarding the first threshold efficiency that you mentioned, and that not necessarily having too big a cost, I'm actually trying to, or I am scheduling an interview with Callum Brownstein, who was a PhD researcher at the University of Saint-Étienne, and they did some really interesting research around that when you're working at 90%, the neuromuscular fatigue when you're working at 90% of that first threshold was the same as at 70%, so pretty much identical. And neuromuscular aspects are only one aspect, of course, there are others, but it was a cool study. And then as soon as you went to 110%, that's when you started to see the big increases in neuromuscular fatigue. And I do think that the measure of neuromuscular fatigue is quite probably one of the most important fatigue measures that you can do, because that will impact how you do in your following sessions more so perhaps than I think that some of the heart rate variability recovery studies have done. But yeah, that's just a side point, but there's something to that, what you just said, to the intuition.
Yeah.
And running, what are the key principles in running for you?
I think running for me is the thing which is most individualized, and it comes from a place of what loads athletes can tolerate. So I find that running is the discipline which leads to most injury and most time away from training. So, again, from a if you're looking at the longer distance side of things, I would place a heavy emphasis on that first threshold and the efficiency around it. And obviously, the shorter the distance you go, the more you're kind of trying to develop efficiency around second threshold, and VO2 plays more of a part. But fundamentally, it's similar in terms of intensity distribution through the week. But it depending on the individual and what they can tolerate, it may be more heavily weighted towards aerobic and underpinned more by drills-based work. And then, again, intensity of a session, as I would see it, is for me determined more by what the athlete can tolerate. I think I've learned a lot around particularly working in para, where depending on impairment, there's a lot more asymmetries that you're considering, particularly around running, load bearing. You're dealing with run blades and how that impacts movement quality, load, etc., etc. So, yeah, I find running is a lot down to the individual and what they can tolerate, and so it becomes quite bespoke from there.
Do you find that volume or intensity is the biggest culprit when it comes to injuries, or are both can both be equally culpable?
I think from what I've experienced intensity, so the quicker you run, obviously the higher the load through the bones and tendon ligament structures. But I also, kind of coming back to a point I was making earlier, it's like, what's the total load of the week and what's the contribution of swimming, cycling and running? Often running is the thing that occupies least amount of time in the week, but it's generally where injuries come from most. So I think definitely intensity contributes to that and how mechanically you're moving under fatigue. And that's, for me, that's another big component. Is it's one thing to run really well in isolation, but how do you mechanically move when you're fatigued and coming off a bike where you just work really hard? But yeah, volume can also play a part, but I tend to find it's more the global volume of triathlon training rather than like just running in isolation.
Yeah. And when discussing the program in its entirety, for example, a weekly cycle or a macro cycle, you've already mentioned some things around how you balance the intensity with the aerobic work. But is there anything else that you can share around, for example, do you work with a recovery or deload week structure, or do you tend to have every week similar but have a couple of easier days in there, or how do you balance the macro cycles or the micro cycles?
It varies based on individual to individual and what they're able to tolerate. So I'm certainly not somebody that's like, right, everybody's 3 weeks on, 1 week off. And that's the way to train for triathlon. But it's understanding like what the individual can tolerate, where you're at, like what the emphasis is in terms of training. So, you know, if you're deliberately targeting a training block which requires higher intensity, then you're going to need to account for recovery within that, because I think the bit which is often most understood is that adaptation happens when you're recovering, not when you're training. So you have, like, at various points, you have to prioritize recovery. But it's really individual. Like, I've had athletes who, and it kind of ties in a little bit with that Ferrari engine versus diesel engine, but I've had athletes that that really need quite frequent rest and really benefit from a rest day each week. I've had athletes that tend to be more diesel engines who can literally go, you know, same week in, week out for a 8 week period, and the quality of what they're delivering is really good, and they just kind of adapt to the training that's been given and recover within it. But I think it generally is a consequence of more diesel. The more diesel engine you are, the less you can access top end, so kind of the less damage you're able to do to yourself. Whereas if you're kind of a Ferrari engine and really anaerobic, and I'm talking anaerobic in terms of endurance, right? So it's still away from sprinting, but you can certainly do more damage to yourself, and so the need to recover is more significant. I think age also, like timing, training history, the age that you're at, the number of years in the sport also play a part. But it ranges massively. Like for some athletes, I have a consistent weekly structure that they follow. For other athletes, we work on a 2-week cycle, and we tap into all different energy zones over the course of 2 weeks. It's massively dependent on who the athlete is, what they're training for, and what they can tolerate.
Yeah, just going to make a note there that with regard to the Ferrari versus diesel discussion, I did an episode of that, an interview with Dr. Phil Bellinger, so I'll link to that in the show notes, where they measured the muscle fiber composition of athletes and then tried different kinds of overload periods, and they found exactly that the more slow twitch dominant athletes, they could have a larger overload without rest, but the fast twitch athletes, they required more rest to be able to adapt to the training. So one final question on this section of the podcast is, how do you implement testing in your athletes program?
Yeah, so I'm really fortunate that I, again, working in a federation, I have access to physiology. So or physiology support. So a guy called Ben Stevenson is a physiologist that works with us on the para side of things. I think the biggest thing that I've learned from testing is whatever protocol you come up with, it has to be relevant for what it is you're trying to understand, but it also has to be measured consistently. And so we've gone around the houses with various different testing protocols over the years, you know, whether that be a second fresh, you know, a sub max test or max test or critical power test or whatever. And I think the thing I always come back to is like, what's of most use to the individual? So what's going to help in like, why are you doing it? And then can you consistently measure it? And again, just due to the support that we have available to us, we tend to at the moment go down a testing protocol of submax max across swim, bike, run. We're just in the process of trying to establish a bit more of a triathlon specific protocol. So looking at how bike influences running. Bike to run and swim to bike. But it's not something which is a concrete protocol at the moment. It's more just an exploration of, really. But yeah, there's nothing in there. I think like my experience with critical power stuff was good in terms of understanding that a bit, what we were discussing earlier, that diesel Ferrari engine and anaerobic capacity. But I find that the submax max testing is a better educational tool for athletes in terms of training zones that you get from it and how to kind of distribute training intensity and load through the week. So we use it on an individual basis. And then I think the bit which is part of a longer term project is to understand trends through the sport. And I think that's something which we probably haven't done as well. But to certainly make it a concerted effort to move towards is just like generations of athletes coming through. What does that look like? And what's their kind of physiological profile that has enabled them performances over the years?
Mm. And how do you currently, what protocol do you typically have in place or currently have in place for the submax max testing that you're doing?
So the submax bike is the kind of, it's 3-minute stages or four. I do move to 4-minute stages, but kind of the standard 3 to 4 minute stages, and then similarly for the run side of things as well. The max, we're actually experimenting at the moment.
Is that lactate and VO2 or only one or the other?
So that we were just experimenting with it's lactate and and masks. But just on the run side of things, we've moved more towards doing the max test off the back of the submax. So rather than having them two tests in isolation, it's basically kind of a continuation of increasing speed. One second threshold is hit, which I think is nicer for the athletes because it means they just have, well, I don't know if it is nicer, but they have one test to focus on. They're obviously going to have, you know, working through the spectrum of submax through to max.
So then after you go through those 3 to 4 minute stages, you hit the second threshold, then the ramp just becomes steeper. So it increases every half a minute or every minute until exhaustion. Okay.
Yeah, until they fall off, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah. all right. And I have some questions about paratriathlon. So first of all, I'm sure there are many listeners that are not fully aware of the classification systems that are used there. So can you talk about that to start us off?
Yeah. So essentially in paratriathlon, there are 12 categories, six of them male, six of them female. There's a PTWC, which is effectively the wheelchair category, and that is split into H1s and H2s. So there's what is called a factor within the wheelchair category, and that caters for kind of the range of disability, so where people are impaired from. So H1s are more disabled than H2s, and there is a time differential within that to account for that. You then have PTVI, which is for visually impaired athletes, and similar to the wheelchair athletes, there's a time factor. So there's B1s who are fully blind, B2s and 3s that are partially sighted. And again, there's a time factor that accounts for the difference of disability within the category. And in essence, that's to ensure that there's depth of field, because there isn't the number of athletes to differentiate between the two. And then you have the ambulant classes, the PTS categories ranging from 2 to 5, to PTS2s, PTS3s, PTS4s, PTS5s. 2s are the most impaired standing classes, and 5s is the least impaired. So you kind of go through a range of different impairments, and that all sits under the classification system. Athletes at the start of their kind of sporting journey are classified nationally first, and then in order to race internationally, they have to go through international classification. They're given the category that they then race in, and that is reviewed on a basis which is determined by the sport and the classification system. So some athletes are reviewed every couple of years, some athletes are reviewed every 3-4 years. It just depends on whether the classifier feels that their impairment will alter or will change in a short space of time or not, basically.
And can you discuss some of the challenges that paratriathletes face in their day-to-day training, and how they and you as a coach overcome them? So for example, with visually impaired athletes, some of them they compete with a guide, but is the guide always available for the swim sessions, or how do those things work?
I think a lot of it depends on the impairment that the athlete has. So visually impaired is probably the most notable example, and actually within our program we only have B2, B3 athletes, so we don't have anybody who is fully blind. And so for the most part, all our athletes can swim in a pool without a guide. Obviously, they ride on a tandem regardless. And the majority can run without a guide as well, which may sound quite strange, but... I think in terms of accommodating or how things change day to day, it really comes down to the impairment and the individual. And I think I've kind of just, having worked in paratriathlon for the last 3 and a bit years, I'm almost unaware of the natural habits that I've developed. And it's everything from kind of the simple nuances of, you know, if you're referring to a pace clock and you've got visually impaired swimmers in the water, I'll always go, you know, we're going next top and that's in 30 seconds time. So, you know, there's an awareness of time. And I think I almost see how you adjust things is more based on how you would adjust things for almost any individual based on their need. I think actually the challenges that I see are more like societal awarenesses of disability. I think particularly like for wheelchair athletes in particular, it's almost like how society is set up to enable or disable them based on the facilities and the thought that's gone into, you know, how access is to a race site or a hotel venue or a restaurant or things like that. I think it's the challenges we encounter are more down to the lack of thoughts gone into creating disability friendly environments. And I know that that's a huge frustration, and rightly so, of many of our wheelchair athletes, because I think it's a really hard thing to for people to be conscious of and to recognise. And I think I often find that you have wheelchair athletes who either like don't want to make a scene or don't want to make a fuss, and they kind of they go along with stuff and things that aren't adequate and aren't set up to support them, because it's they don't want to be kind of the seen to be the angry disabled person that isn't catered for. But I think working in para triathlon, you just really realize the lack of awareness and the lack of just stuff that is in place to enable people rather than disable them.
I can imagine even like traveling to races, that must be a completely different experience, much more challenging for wheelchair bound athletes than for people that are not wheelchair bound. Like that's not something that we think of normally if we're not in that situation.
But yeah, and I think
that's an added stress.
Yeah, even down to like race course design, like that's probably one of my biggest frustrations with World Triathlon is the amount of times we've turned up to a race and they've got steps on the swim exit, or you know, they've got an entrance to the swim that isn't accessible, or they put a race briefing in a hotel that isn't accessible or whatever, or a tent in the middle of a field that isn't accessible. And I actually think that there's a huge amount that could be done from just an event organisation perspective that again can just consider the needs of athletes. And I see it as our job as a sport to enable, not to disable.
Yeah, yeah. Are there any differences in how paratriathletes train compared with, let's say, in this case, able-bodied athletes on for draft legal racing or for short distance racing, because that's kind of the most relevant comparison? Are there any differences there?
Yeah, well, I think like the demands of the race is slightly different. So, you know, field sizes are significantly smaller. So athletes will generally set off with about in groups of nine. That varies a little bit on the VI side of things, but the field size is fundamentally much smaller. So that kind of tussle around the first buoy and number of people and getting beaten up doesn't exist in the same way. So it's probably less demanding in terms of the nuances and skills that you need to navigate a group swim. Obviously, from a bike perspective, it's non-drafting. It's 20K. I say it's non-drafting, like it's 10 meters, so you still get a good draft. It's just not group racing. So again, you're not really needing to train that stochastic element that's needed on the Olympic side and the group skills that are needed on the Olympic side. But you are, I think there's a lot of comparison between paratri and the long distance side of things when it comes to pacing your way through an effort or the aerodynamic element of racing. And then obviously from a run perspective, that's probably the thing which is closest aligned. It's 5K and ultimately you're trying to run as quick as you can. But again, depending on the category, the race dynamic is slightly different. And I think obviously for wheelchair athletes, it's a push. It's not a run. So the time spent pushing is significantly less than what it would be running, because they're so much quicker. So there's different nuances for sure, but also many similarities.
Hmm. Are there any differences in things like training volume or such?
I think. It's probably, in my experience, is more, you have to be more conscious of, ultimately, you're trying to build training volume. But I think impairment certainly plays a bigger factor in how much you can acquire, particularly in certain disciplines. So, if you're a below knee amputee, just generally like the challenges around stump health, how much run volume you can tolerate without your stump being an issue, how that interacts with your blade. Obviously, you've got carbon on one side and the trainer on the other. And so the forces that generate, like carbon generates versus not a different. So you're more working around the impairment. And that certainly impacts training volume for different athletes. I think the other bit which is different is that, again, just down to the where the sport is at in terms of its development stage, you can have athletes coming into the sport with relatively little history and achieving success pretty quickly. So if I take Katie Crowhurst, who was gold medalist at the Commonwealth Games, few weeks back in Birmingham, she started the sport just over a year ago. From like literally, she came from a swim background, but she started, and then in under a year, she was Commonwealth Games champion. And that simply wouldn't happen on the Olympic side because the depth and the standard is just much more developed and much higher. And so I think the challenge is you have athletes that are really early on into their journey, but due to their the standard of the sport and the depth of the sport, they're able to achieve equivalent, a lot of success. And I think that's quite hard at times for athletes and staff to wrap their head around. Is, you're basically a year one athlete that is achieving what, an athlete on the Olympic side would be achieving 10, 15 years into their career kind of thing. And so the balance of that, it can be quite tricky to navigate at times.
Mm, yeah. And you mentioned already some of the things that you've changed in coaching, for example, with calling out the times for the visually impaired athletes and so on. Are there any other things that you change in your day-to-day coaching, any just practical things that might be curious for the listeners to know? But also, maybe more importantly, are there any things in general in your coaching that you have realized and learned and improved through your involvement in paratriathlon?
I think it's really tricky to answer because I think as I said before I kind of categorize it as coaching the individual. So there probably are nuances that are I've altered the way in which I do things due to working in paratriathlon, but I almost see it as I'm just working with the individual athlete. I think a lot more time has been spent on equipment, and it's afforded me to think about things very differently. So as an example, Claire Cashmore, who's one of the athletes that I work with, she's a below elbow amputee. And so you know, you think about riding a bike. Well, you can't just jump on an off-the-peg bike because you can't use both brakes. And so there are modifications that need to be made there. And then also how you ride safely when you haven't, you know, you haven't got a limb below the elbow. But it's actually led to some really like cool, innovative ways of thinking. So we went for a project in the run up to Tokyo around developing a stump cup for Claire that would allow her to be in an aerodynamic position. But then she was riding the specialized shiv, which for the listeners that are aware, like the shiv has a handlebar setup, which means it packs down to be packed, so the base bar folds inwards. It's also removable. So for Claire, it was like, well, actually, you don't need that side of the base bar because you're not using it. So we removed it. And again, you're kind of saving watts and you're making it more aerodynamic. And that's something which you would never consider because there wouldn't be a need for a non-disabled athlete. And so, yeah, I think you take similarly with George Peasgood, who I work with, like he has a semi-fused ankle and a big leg length discrepancy. And so again, you're thinking about, okay, well, how do we make him more symmetrical and remove some of the asymmetries that he has in his movement pattern? And suddenly you get into like, well, he probably needs like a Hoka Bondi on his shorter leg and something like a Kinvara on his longer leg to make him more balanced. And actually the carbon shoe revolution that has happened and stack height and bits and pieces has opened up a whole new world for him in terms of what shoe combinations can work. And it's those bits which, without working in paratriathlon, I would have never been exposed to or even thought about really.
Yeah. No, that's great. And finishing off with some, going back to some general training and coaching questions. First of all, if you could give three pieces of advice for the listeners that would help them improve their triathlon performance, what would that be?
It's probably going to sound really boring, but I think being clear on your priorities. Like I see so many people that go, you know, have aspirations to qualify for Kona or win their age group or be top 10 in the world or whatever, but they don't then go the level deeper of understanding the priorities that are going to lead to that. So I think taking time to really break down what it is you're trying to do, understand how that then leads to being to prioritizing stuff and making space, like we discussed it earlier in the podcast. But if you're going to prioritize something, you have to make space for it. And I think far too often I see athletes wanting to develop in a certain area, but not making the room within their program to do it. And so they end up either overtraining or injured or just making a mess of it. So I think, yeah, be clear on your priorities, make space for them, and be patient. I think that's also, it's one of the hardest things and biggest mistakes that I see people make is they set out to improve their swimming and they give it 3 weeks and then they fall out with it because they're not seeing the improvements that they want. And triathlon is a long game. It takes patience, it takes time, and you have to love the process, you have to love the training, and recognize that it's years upon years of investment, not 3 weeks and you'll see, you know, huge shifts. So yeah, they would be the main bits, I would say.
Yeah, no, I think that's all great advice. And on the be clear on your priorities, you talked a lot about it at the beginning of the podcast with the gap analysis and knowing the demands of the sport and where you are now. And I think that's something that a lot of listeners would benefit from doing for themselves, doing a proper gap analysis with structure, and then suddenly the priorities become so much easier to make out and see where we really should be spending your time. And Are there any common mistakes in training or in racing that you would warn against, that you see a lot of people committing and would suggest not to do?
I think there's plenty of stuff that you kind of observe. I think generally, if I were to generalize around what I see age group athletes doing most of, is kind of getting stuck in just gray zone training. So I think often time starved athletes tend to go down a route of, well, I've not got much time, so I'll just make everything hard. But then it's never super hard and it's never easy. So you end up just in this gray zone. And I think for periods of time that can work. But when you're doing it year upon year, I think it becomes really limiting, and it kind of comes back to like priorities, making space for stuff, being comfortable with, in order to make stuff, it may feel like you're giving up on an area that you would consider a strength. And I kind of see people, yeah, just wanting to do more, but not prepared to let stuff go. And so I think a common mistake would be, it kind of harks back to the piece of advice, but just try to understand what it is you're trying to do and prioritize it. I think the other bit, whether it's a mistake or just an observation, is, and this is predominantly working with world-class program athletes that are well-supported, is I think because it's well-supported, there's a lack of a want to like invest in themselves, and there's a reliance, as I see it, on the federation to, whether it be fund or support or do things for them. And I think why I think that's important is you then lose the why and why you're doing stuff, and that kind of accountability to yourself, because stuff's just being done for you. And I think it's probably the more negative side of all the great stuff of being involved in a nation that's well supported and supports elite sport. I think too much of that can lead to just not complacency, but just a lack of wanting to invest, whether it be time or resource or finance in yourself. And I think it ultimately leads to people becoming a bit lost.
Yeah. And is there something that you've changed your mind about in terms of training or coaching in the last few years, and that you do differently now than you used to?
Yeah, I think, again, when I think about when I started coaching initially, I just would be on, like switched on all the time. And I would see it as, you know, if an athlete's training however many hours a week, I've seen it as my responsibility to just be there, be attentive, be, you know, be present. Even if I kind of felt like I knew that I wasn't necessarily needed, but just by being present, I would show to the athlete that I'm invested in what they're doing. And I think it's kind of a similar analogy to what I use with the gray zoning age group athlete, which is, I think, what I've changed my mind on and learned is that actually balancing what I do is the most critical thing, and learning when to dial myself up from a coaching perspective. So one of the important parts through the year where I really need to kind of dial up and be more present, and where are the points in the year where it can be a little bit more athlete led and I can recover a bit, take a bit more time to be a bit more balanced, because that's when I get the most from myself as a coach, I think. And I still am not brilliant at it. It's still a work on, but I think from a coaching perspective, because you're generally motivated by wanting to help people, wanting to do the very best by athletes, you can end up just wanting to be there, you know, at everything, there all the time, present. And I just found that it made me a grey zone of a coach, and actually, you know, periodizing how I structure my time, when I dial up, when I dial down, is really important.
Yeah, that's great advice. And is there anything in particular that you're focused on right now as part of your coaching development?
It's pretty much that, like figuring out, like certainly not the finished article by any stretch, but it's figuring out how to be sustainable as a coach. And I've been coaching for 10 years now, and I want to be coaching in 20 years' time. And I recognize that within that, I will coach a good number of athletes, but I will need to be the consistent over that time frame. And so figuring out how to be sustainable in what I'm doing is pretty much my biggest focus. And that kind of leans right back to the start of the podcast where I mentioned about stepping away from the role that I'm in at the moment as a paratriathlon coach. And that's all with the emphasis on being sustainable and creating space for myself within what it is I'm trying to do.
Yeah. Perfect. And let's finish off with the rapid fire questions. So take just one sentence to answer each of these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to triathlon or endurance sports?
Richard Williams, Black and White, The Way I See It. It was his autobiography. His father, right. Serena Williams and Venus Williams.
Yeah, cool. And what's an important habit you benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
Run every day.
And finally, who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
I wouldn't say it's one person, but anybody who is just committed to bettering themselves and being a better human it inspires me.
Yeah, perfect. And finally, where can people find you online and on social media? And tell them about your private coaching is rolling out fully, so that people can follow along.
Yeah, so you can find me on Instagram or Facebook at Bex Milnes Coaching. And then I have a website, which is kind of a holding page at the moment, but bexmilnescoaching.com. And that's due to launch in start of December. So yeah, that's where you can find out more.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Bex. It was great to talk to you. And hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thanks for your time.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, where we'll have links to Bex's website and Instagram, as well as a couple of related episodes that we mentioned throughout this interview, and the book that Bex recommended by Richard Williams, the father of Venus and Serena Williams. If you want to improve your triathlon performance and want help to achieve your goals, then consider working with a scientific triathlon coach or training plan. We would love to help you, whether you're just getting into triathlon or trying to qualify for a world championship event or even want to race professionally. These are all scenarios where we have experience and would love to discuss further on if and how we can help you on your triathlon journey. Find out more and contact us on scientifictriathlon.com, and we can discuss your specific goals and needs and see what's best for you. Next Monday, I interview Dr. Tim Podlogar, and the topic will be all things carbohydrate. Essentially, we will do a full review of the state-of-the-art knowledge of the science and practice of carbohydrate for endurance athletes with one of the foremost experts in the world on that topic. Finally, a big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Use their free fuel and hydration planner to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs and get a specific and effective race strategy, and book a free video consultation with the team if you want to refine it further. Use the code TTS22 at checkout for 15% off your first order of fueling and hydration products. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, and exceptional sunglasses and prescription glasses for everything from day-to-day wear to extreme action sports. Use the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS to get 20% off your entire Roka order. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.